you know, not only is the Reduce Shakespeare Company podcast, it's just an audio journal of wherever we go around the world, backstage in vans and theaters, et cetera, et cetera. It's also a celebration of making a living in the theater.
Right. Okay.
And Mark Dold, my guest today, is somebody you've never heard of, but he is a working actor, goddammit.
Yes, I am. Goddammit. Oh, I can say that on a podcast?
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever it is, wherever you are. Thanks for subscribing, streaming, or downloading and listening to us on your computer or MP3 player. I'm Austin Titchener, one third of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, and you're listening to this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast number 283, Freud's Last Session. Mark Dold is an old friend of mine from both Boston University and American Stage Festival who came through Chicago this winter to reprise his role as C.S. Lewis in the surprisingly long-running off-Broadway play Freud's Last Session, which continues to play in New York, Chicago, and now there's talk of an L.A. production as well. Not only was it great to see an old friend, but the story of his relationship with this script illustrates so many of the vagaries of an actor's life and career. Freud's Last Session tells the story of a hypothetical meeting between Sigmund Freud and Oxford professor C.S. Lewis in 1939, on the eve of World War II and before Lewis had begun writing his Chronicles of Narnia. Mark began by telling me the origins of the play.
You know how the whole thing is born? It's based on a Harvard University professor named Dr. Armand Nicolai. He taught a school in the taught a class in the med school called The Question of God. And it was a discussion about, you know, does God exist? And he used Sigmund Freud and C.S. Lewis as the kind of the cornerstones of either side of the argument.
Oh.
And would open it up ready to discuss. It was a hugely popular class at Harvard, hugely popular. Couldn't get in, couldn't find a seat. Somebody urged him to write a book, so he wrote a book about it.
Uh-huh.
There's also a great PBS documentary, kind of a roundtable discussion based on it as well. Great. See it if you can.
Right.
There's a little kernel at the end of the book, and it says, on September the 3rd, 1939, the day England joined World War II, an Oxford University professor stopped by Freud's house. Wouldn't it be fascinating if, in fact, it was C.S. Lewis? What would they have talked about?
Oh, cool.
Our playwright read the book and thought, that's my next play.
And the playwright is Marc Saint-Germain, is that how you
say it? Yeah, Marc Saint-Germain.
Saint-Germain, who has also written another, at least one other hypothetical kind of play, Camping with Henry and Tom.
Camping with Henry and Tom. And he's got another great play coming out soon, hopefully called Best of Enemies. He likes to take real people, unconventional pairings, and kind of throw them in a room or throw them in circumstances and kind of shut them in and see what happens.
Right.
Like Henry Ford and Thomas Edison.
Yeah.
Like Sigmund Freud and C.S. Lewis.
Well, it's a great gimmick. Our friend Russ Lees wrote Nixon's Nixon, between Nixon and Kissinger. Similar idea.
Yeah, it's a great idea.
But then talk about how this gig came to you, because it was supposed to be just a 2-week gig and now it's been over 2 years.
Right, and going back even a little bit further, it's totally a mistake that I'm, you know, with the job. There was a reading of it in New York. The guy who was supposed to play Lewis got sick. I got a phone call from the woman who was hosting the reading, who happens to be a friend of mine, saying, this is a 911 phone call. We've got this play. It's called Freud's Last Session. It's dense. You're not going to get it all in one reading, but we need someone to walk and talk these words tomorrow in front of about 300 people. Please tell me you're free. And I said...
And this was in New York City?
This was in New York, yeah, the summer or fall of 08. And I said, great. Because I loved everybody involved. I kind of knew the playwright, and I know this woman well.
Well, and actors, you never say no.
Exactly.
You always say yes.
Especially interesting material like this. I read it once that night. I thought, good God, what am I getting myself into? I have no idea what I'm saying, but I'll go and do it anyway. The next day, I was in front of 300 people reading this play out loud, and I was hooked.
Yeah.
I mean, it had me. And then about 4 months after that, I got a phone call from the same woman who is the artistic director of Barrington Stage Company in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, in the Berkshires, saying we are green-lighting the first production of this play, and we want you to stay in the role of C.S. Lewis. So it's all because someone got sick. And that someone actually happens to be one of my best friends. So thank you, Chris. He's fine. He's in Porgy and Bess on Broadway right now, so he's doing fine.
He's doing okay.
Yeah.
Wow, an African-American C.S. Lewis. That would have been a very interesting choice.
He plays the only white guy in Porgy and Bess, the sheriff.
Another distinction.
Yes.
Yeah.
You can't miss him.
And so that run at Barrington Stage was only going to be 2 weeks.
So that run was only supposed to be 2 weeks long. And it was maybe not an overnight success, but about 48 hours later, maybe our third performance, people finally started showing up. And then our fourth performance, people started standing up at the end of it. And our fifth performance, there was a waiting list. And our sixth performance, people were scalping tickets. And it just kept kind of snowballing like that. Then we added a week to that run. It was so successful, the artistic director, Julie, then said, will you guys come back later in the season? They had a show that, because of contracts, had suddenly dropped out. So we came back about a month and a half later, and that run got extended again. And they do a fall show every year. She said, listen, will you guys come back in the fall? We'll make you our fall show. We came back in the fall, and then we got extended again. And that time, once we came back for the fall show, we heard that New York producers were buzzing around.
Okay.
And sometime after that fall, this is now the fall of 2009, we found out that the show was moving to New York. And it moved to New York in the summer, July 2010, and it's still running almost 2 years later.
But it went to New York with you.
Correct, and that's the beautiful thing.
That
some of the beauty of it is that Mark St. Germain, the playwright, because the first thing the producers were like, great, who can we get?
Right.
Is Dustin Hoffman free?
For instance.
Right, for instance. .. And the playwright said, beautifully, if this show moves, I won't let this show move without these two actors, because what you are seeing on that stage is not what I wrote. I wrote one thing, they have turned it into something else. And what people are responding to, I think, fundamentally, is what they've done to my material as opposed to what I've written.
Yeah.
And if anything happens, we have to honor these two guys and what they brought to this process, and let it be them.
Well, it's not only what you bring to the words, but it's the hours that you guys have spent on stage together.
Yeah.
You have a history together.
Yeah, now we've done the show over 800 times, almost 2 years. I mean, we've both taken little vacations here and there, but we're bonded in a way now that...
And you are then now you have two. You are now currently, as we talk.
Oh, yes.
You and Martin are here in Chicago, opening the Chicago company. Then by the time this podcast actually airs, you might be back in New York. You and Martin back in New York doing the play still.
Right. We signed on for. We're here to launch the Chicago Freud's Last Session company.
Yeah.
The idea was bring the original actors here for 6 weeks, kind of do a straight from New York thing. See if this show hits here, because, you know, if it didn't, you know, they would just quietly leave town.
Right.
Fortunately, the show is a success here, where they have now cast two great Chicago actors to replace us, and we go back to New York, where the show is still running. They replaced us briefly in New York. And we go back and continue to run in New York, and the show's on sale there through September.
Wow.
So what do you think? So Mark said that wonderful thing about you and Martin. What do you think you brought to the part of C.S. Lewis? How did you connect to it? You know what I'm asking?
I do, and I don't really know if I'm going to be able to answer the question, but I think Martin Rayner, who is my co-star, brilliant man, brilliant actor, playing Freud, I think what we've managed to do is really humanize these two men. And I think we've managed to take what should feel kind of like an academic exercise and really personalize it and make it very human.
Yeah.
So you don't spend an hour and a half with two talking heads. You really feel like you're meeting two really interesting, complicated, clever, bright, but real men talking about things that actually matter, life, sex, love, loss.
Yeah.
God, yeah. You know. I think we've managed to find real people in these icons, people that I think the audience members can really associate with.
I think you absolutely nailed it. Yeah, that's a great answer, because Freud particularly is such a stereotype, and
Absolutely.
He is so human, so real, even with all of his tics and
Absolutely.
His phlegm wrangling.
Yeah.
And you stride onto the stage looking like a young Colin Firth, goddamn.
And also, I have to admit, I look nothing like a 41-year-old C.S. Lewis, which I was kind of panicked about.
Yeah, thank goodness. Nobody wants to look like that.
No, it's funny. I mean, you know, people have everybody's got kind of a stamp of Freud in their brain, what he looks like. So Martin and I had very different jobs, too. He had boxes. We had different boxes we had to tick. People were going to expect to see the glasses and the cigar and and the accent and whatever. And he had to make sure he hit all those things.
Yeah.
For me, my job was different. I didn't know where to begin, you know?
Right.
I thought initially, should I make myself look more like Lewis? But fortunately, most people don't know what the hell he looked like.
Yeah, and it doesn't matter.
And it doesn't matter. Yeah. And at the end of the day, it really doesn't matter.
This is Ken Marks. I play Uncle Ben in Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark, and you're listening to the Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast.
Where can you RSC the RSE? This spring and summer of 2012, you'll be able to RSC us in 34 cities in the U.S. and the U.K., including cities like Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, York, Buxton, Exeter, Newbury, Nottingham, Truro, Poole, Tunbridge Wells, Peterborough, Canterbury, Derby, Hereford, Rhyl, Barnsley, Salford, Basingstoke, Crawley, where we hope to meet Lord and Lady Grantham, Bedford, Tewkesbury, and London, returning to the Arts Theatre. And for a short time only, the Arts Theatre in London is selling a reduced number of tickets per performance for the special London Olympics 2012 price of 2012. As always, the very best way to stay up to date about all of our worldwide performance dates is to sign up for the Reduced Reader, our email newsletter. Go to ReducedShakespeare.com and click on the link to subscribe and check out our touring page for specific box office venue and ticket information. And now back to my conversation with Mark Dold.
We know each other because you were an undergraduate actor at Boston University.
I was.
When I was a graduate director, so we go way back.
But you know what? Did we ever actually work together?
We didn't, and I was...
You never cast me.
No, that's... hang on, that's not true, because I have cast you.
That's true.
Yes, okay, because you have a small collection of scripts with your name in it from the original cast.
Yes.
And so you came up to spend a summer with me at American Stage Festival in
1987. I was 10 years old.
You were
12.
and you were in the original production of my adaptation of Kafka's Metamorphosis called Dancing on the Ceiling,
yes.
Where you played Gregor's mother.
Gregor's mother wearing white, no, yellow, those yellow dishwashing gloves with a really bad white kind of like curly, like Phyllis Diller wig.
Yeah.
And I had an absolute blast. It was brilliant. It's a brilliant script.
Well, and you committed 100%, as did all the actors, but everybody committed so 100%.
Yes.
But
everyone crossed. Cross-dressing, by the way, not just me.
Yeah, that part of one of my directorial playwriting conceit was that boys played girls played boys, because then she turns into a bug, and so, okay.
So who cares,
what
your gender is.
Right, and it's a play about identity, blah, blah, blah. But, you then went from all of that grandness to Yale Drama School.
Yes.
So how did you go from undergraduate actor, semi-professional actor, coming up to do a season of summer stock?
Yes.
How did that all work for you?
Okay, well, we graduated from Boston University. You had a job, clearly. I did not. I couldn't get arrested. Thank God you guys called me to invite me up there, because I met a lovely guy who then became a great friend, who introduced me to an agent, whatever, and I began to work in New York just a little bit.
Great.
But
That's right. You were as an intern, you were in the production of Biloxi Blues, which then toured to different theaters.
Correct, because there was an Equity, we did the children's stuff, but there was the Equity Theater attached.
Right.
And there was that one show, the last show of the season, Biloxi Blues, where they needed one non-Equity actor.
Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, I think the director, Martin Herzer, rest his soul, is no longer with us, but he came to see Midsummer Night's Dream.
Oh.
The cut Midsummer Night's Dream that we did as the Young Company.
Yeah.
And he said, "Who's that guy? Is he a non-ec?" And that's how I ended up getting the part.
Awesome.
So I met Mitchell, and the rest is history. But
So then you started to get some work in New York?
Yeah, I started to get some work, but not enough, and I was frustrated, and I knew that my education at BU was a good one. But, you know, you're a kid when you go through college, and possibly with a program that intense, I was underdeveloped, and I came out still underdeveloped, and it was showing in my work still. So I thought, you know, it's time for me now, more developed, to go back to school. So I, out of frustration, really, I picked one drama school, and I said to myself, I'm going to audition once. So I picked Yale, because I just thought, well, it seems like...
Yeah, they're not too bad.
Yeah, not too shabby, one of the poshest. I also didn't... Juilliard, they only offer a BFA. I already had a BFA from BU, so why get another BFA? Yeah. So I auditioned for Yale, and I got in. And for a second, I thought I had ruined my life, because I'd worked for 4 years after graduating from BU, you know, for working really hard to get a little bit of...
Traction.
But everybody seemed to think that going to Yale was a smart thing to do. I'll never forget my agent at the time, Jerry Hogan, Henderson Hogan, God rest his soul.
Yeah. Way to go. You are just leaving a trail of bodies.
I'm killing everybody. Everybody works with me, then dies.
I'm going to be very careful driving home after this.
That's right. You can be very careful. He said to me, you're going to be a much more interesting young leading man than you are an aging juvenile.
Yeah.
And I thought, that's interesting.
Well, and more interesting people make more interesting actors.
Yes, yes. So I said goodbye to New York City for 3 years, went to the Yale School of Drama, and it ends up still, now 16 years later, being one of the smartest things I've ever done in my life. Not necessarily because it was the Yale School of Drama, just because I was now in a place where I was really ready to learn. I was mature, I had a sense of myself. I knew the business a little bit, so I knew what was going to be expected of me, which I didn't know before, you know, after graduating from
it would have been wasted on you earlier.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So I felt like I graduated from Yale a little bit more ahead of the game, and I can proudly say for the past 16 years now, I am a working actor.
That's so awesome. And people must look at you. You came out of Yale, and so I bet casting people, directors, looked at you differently, right, when you walked in?
Sure. I mean...
You still had to have the goods.
Absolutely. And, you know, it doesn't necessarily... I mean, in all these years later, nobody cares where I went to school.
Right.
It's not an issue anymore. It's still on my resume, of course, but nobody... You know, people think that there are these mafias and stuff, and maybe there are, but frankly, I've never felt the effects of it.
Okay.
I don't necessarily feel like I got a job specifically because I went to the Yale School of Drama.
Right.
But I did. I can now go back and say that I very specifically got a job because I went to the Boston University School for the Arts, and that was, you know, you offered me a gig.
Yeah, that's true.
I don't know. I mean, nobody I've been to. Well, that's not true. Yeah, some people from Yale have offered me gigs, but.
But that's the thing. Work leads to work, right?
Of course.
Yeah. I mean, you said yes to this Freud play, and it led to work.
And the crazy thing is it's leading to me reconnecting with you, too, out of the blue, getting an email.
Yeah.
Hey, guess who's back in Chicago?
Right.
You know, I thought you and, you know, were lost in Los Angeles.
I was lost in Los Angeles, which is why I now live in Chicago.
Yeah, I know.
So what's next? You go back to New York, you're going to go back to Freud's last session, and
you know, I feel like sooner or later, probably sooner, I'm going to have to start looking for... something else. Again, this job was supposed to be a one-night gig.
Right.
A reading. And then it became a two-week gig, and now it's been almost 3 years. So to say goodbye to it is going to be tough. But also, you know, I'm ruined now in a little bit of a way because I don't want to just leave it for another job.
Right.
It can't just be a job.
Yeah.
It's got to be something that's going to be... at least equally as meaningful as this has, but, you know, God love it. I mean, that's going to be impossible to match.
Or just something different that's also cool in a different way.
Yeah, or something that just happens to pay me an absurd amount of money.
That would be the ideal.
I am always down for that.
That's it for this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast. Send us your Freudian interpretations via email to feedback@reducedshakespeare.com. You can also post comments on many of our website pages, and you can post reviews on iTunes. You can interact with other fans at our website and our Reduced Shakespeare Company Facebook fan page. You can also become a subscriber to our YouTube channel or become a twit. Follow us on Twitter at Reduced. You can find easy links to all these social networks at our website, reducedshakespeare.com. Thanks, as always, to webmaster Matt Rippey, Jungian Matthew Croak, music by John Weber and GarageBand. Our random fan shout-out this week goes to Nomi Burstein. No reason, it's just random. Special thanks to Ken Marks, who was shockingly ignored by the Tony Committee for his work as Uncle Ben in Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark. And to Mark Dold. We didn't even have time to talk about his adventures working with Mike Nichols or Meryl Streep or Philip Seymour Hoffman. Oh, well, next time. And thanks very much to you for listening. I'm Austin Titchener, 283/849 of the Reduced Shakespeare Company. Ladies and gentlemen, a working actor.
A working actor, and you know that's all I ever really wanted to be.
This podcast is a production of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, reducing expectations since 1981. Go to reducedshakespeare.com for performance dates, actor bios, email newsletters, and so much less.
So much less. So much less.